Okay, let me start by thanking the organizers for letting me give this talk. And as this is supposed to be some type of a review talk, I will do some longer introduction where I remind you about what has been known for, well, I should probably say almost 30 years about phase transitions and disorder, conventional, classical phase transitions, what changes for quantum phase transitions. And then I will focus your attention on the effects of rare regions, and we will see that these rare region effects are strongly enhanced at quantum phase transitions, and they can even be so strong that they completely smear the quantum phase transition. And in the end, I will attempt a classification of quantum phase transitions with weak disorder, and I will say in a second what I mean by weak, according to the importance of the rare regions. Let me briefly flash this and then go on, since for this audience I probably don't have to say much about an introduction into quantum phase transitions. There's one thing which I want to remind you of, and this is...
Excuse me, you want to complain? You want to see the review page?
Pardon?
You go back one page.
One page, this one.
Can you tell us about that?
Well, what I will be telling you about mostly is what happens to quantum phase transitions, and I will be talking both about localized quantum phase transitions, and we have briefly talked about them last week already, and about itinerant quantum phase transitions. If you put in disorder, impurities, and I will emphasize that rare region effects here will be much, much stronger, or here, than they will be at the classical phase transition, which happens here. And there's one important point I want to remind you of in the beginning, which sometimes comes under the name of the quantum to classical mapping, which implies that in some way the imaginary time acts as an additional dimension at the quantum phase transition, and the system becomes infinite in this extra dimension if the temperature goes to zero. Of course, this mapping comes with a number of problems. It holds for the thermodynamics only, which is for our purposes so far good enough. The resulting classical system can be very unusual, and there may be extra complications which I will not be talking about today. Okay, so let me start out by reminding you of what the common law about disorder and phase transitions is. And from the outset, I want to focus on what's sometimes called weak disorder, where the only thing the impurities do is lead to a spatial variation of the coupling strengths, or in the classical case, you would say the critical temperature. In theory, that's typically what's called random mass or random TC type disorder. And according to John Meidrich's talk last week, that may be what the experimentalists or some experimentalists want to call good disorder.
What would be the context of what's wrong with
it? Well, there could be random field type effects, or there could be valence fluctuations, or any other more stronger effects. Right? Okay, as it has been known for a long time, that the effect of such weak disorder is, from a randomization group point of view, is controlled by the Harris criterion, where you compare the variation of the average local coupling constant in blocks of the correlation lengths with the global distance from the critical point. And it's clear, if these variations here are smaller than the global distance from the critical point, then you can get a homogeneous phase transition where the system orders collectively. And working this out is not very complicated and leads you to the well-known relation, spatial dimensionality times clean new correlation length exponent must be larger than 2. And if that happens, then the clean critical behavior is stable against disorder. So putting in some weak disorder will not change the critical behavior at all. Only non-universal quantities will change. What that means is, if you look at your system at larger and larger length scales, it becomes more and more homogeneous, the inhomogeneities vanish, and interestingly, all microscopic observables are self-averaging, which is what you normally imply if you look at disordered systems. We will see later. We will see later on that this is non-trivial for the other cases. And just to give you one example where this scenario is well established, both theoretically and from simulations, this is would be a classical Heisenberg magnet in three dimensions, where this nu is 0.7, and so this is fulfilled here. Okay, before I go on, let me make one remark about the Harris criterion. From what I said, it should be clear that the Harris criterion essentially looks at the behavior of the average disorder strength, something like the typical variation of your disorder at very, very large length scales going to infinity. Of course, that means if there's new physics happening at finite length scales, then this will not be covered by the Harris criterion. And we will see that something like this will be happening in some of the quantum phase transitions. Okay, but let me continue in the story. So what is a common law about cases where the Harris criterion is violated? So the clean critical behavior is unstable against disorder. And then in most classical systems, what happens is that the system goes to a new critical point with different critical exponents, which then fulfill this inequality. However, these fixed points, these critical points, are very interesting in the sense that in this case, the inhomogeneities remain finite at all scales. So the system does not become self-averaging at the critical point. And this can be seen here in this very nice computer simulations of a 3D Ising model, where what's shown here is the probability distribution of the susceptibility at the critical point for various system sizes. And if the system was self-averaging, of course, you would expect this to sharpen up and become a delta function in the thermodynamic limit. But that's not what's happening. So these are five different system sizes plotted on top of each other. And you see that this probability distribution actually becomes a constant. And here you see the width as a function of the system size. And so there's essentially no variation. So here, that means that even in the thermodynamic limit, we get a finite width for the probability distribution of the observables. So the system is non-self-averaging. And that's a typical characteristic of this type of critical point, which you will find if the Harris criterion is violated. And therefore, you may want to call them finite disorder critical points, because the finite disorder survives at all length scales. OK, so these two cases is what essentially is the common picture for classical thermal phase transitions. And the Harris criterion essentially decides between these two possibilities. Now let's go on to quantum phase transitions. And now I want to remind you of this importance of the imaginary time. And if you look at this cartoon here, that we have some space dimensions and we have imaginary time, then it's clear that quench disorder effectively is perfectly correlated in this extra dimension because it's static, right? So we have to deal with correlated disorder. And it's intuitively clear that these strong disorder correlations, these perfect correlations along the time direction, make the disorder effects stronger, at least. The tendency will be towards stronger disorder effects because it's much, much harder to average out a big fluctuation like this as opposed to smaller fluctuations if there was no correlations.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Disorder is quenched, but the correlations increase the effects of disorder.
Quenched in this case means quenched in the sense of statistical mechanics, so they are static. Not time dependent, right? Okay, so therefore, from this hand waving argument, it's clear we should expect stronger disorder effects at a quantum phase transition purely due to the disorder correlations in imaginary time direction. And that this is indeed the case has been shown a long time ago for the random quantum Ising model, which is an Ising model, which is a transverse field, where both, in general at least, both the coupling and the field are random quantities. Right? So that's the random version of arguably the simplest system which can show a quantum phase transition, the transverse Ising model. There is, for this system in 1 plus 1 dimensions, there's an exact solution, which I will not be talking about in detail, which goes back to Daniel Fisher, who applied a version of this Mardash-Gupta-Hu randomization group, which is a real space RG, where you, in each step, integrate out the largest local energy scale. And the nice thing about it, this method is that it becomes exact in the limit of large disorder. So if you apply this method, which can be done exactly in 1 plus 1 dimensions, then you find that something which is very surprising. You find that the disorder actually increases without limit under renormalization. So that's one step stronger than we had before. We had seen in the first case, where the Harris criterion is fulfilled, we found the disorder effectively goes down. Then we had these finite disorder fixed points, which happens in generic classical disorder systems, where the disorder stays constant under RG or with increasing length scale. And here we find that the system actually becomes more and more disordered on larger and larger scales. And so therefore, this type of critical point is called infinite randomness or infinite disorder critical point. And it's clear that this has dramatic consequences. If the disorder becomes infinitely broad, then of course the physics will be dominated by rare events. And among other things, this leads to very slow dynamics. So the dynamical scaling at this infinite randomness critical point becomes an exponential, as we are used to seeing power laws there, right? So that's what's sometimes called activated scaling. And because the disorder becomes infinitely strong, also the distributions of observables become infinitely broad in the thermodynamic limit. And there's been nice numerical work. And I just want to show one picture by Fisher and Young a couple of years ago. And here they look at the end-to-end correlation functions for a finite chain for different lengths, right? And first I want to point your attention to this scale here. You see that's extremely broad, right? And then you see if you go from short chains to longer and longer chains, the distribution becomes even broader and broader and broader. And you see, if, even so, this is a factor, this is 30 on the logarithmic scale here, the width is even much, much, much larger for these longer chains. So indeed, the width of this distribution diverges in the thermodynamic limit. So very, very strong disorder effects. Okay, so this was, in some sense, my introductory part. Now I want to focus your attention on what happens in the vicinity of a phase transition, if any, in a disordered system. I want to talk about rare regions and the Griffith effects which come with them. And again, let's start by looking at the classical case. So let's look at the classical magnet. So let's look at this cartoon here. I've taken them, let's say, a simple Ising model, Ising magnet, and I've diluted it by replacing magnetic with non-magnetic ions, let's say, or just taking spins out here. And of course, it's clear that in general, this will have a tendency to reduce the critical temperature because the tendency towards magnetization goes down. However, due to disorder fluctuations, there can be regions like this where there's no impurities. And they can be arbitrarily large just due to disorder fluctuations. Of course, the probability for finding such a large region becomes very, very small. It becomes exponentially small in the volume. Right? However, the crucial point is that such a rare region like this one here essentially looks like a finite piece of the clean system, right? So therefore, of course, it wants to show local order below the clean critical temperature, even so we have not yet reached the global dirty critical temperature. So in this region here, between the clean and the actual dirty critical temperature, this region wants to show global order, which means the spins here, they are essentially locked together, right? And the entire thing will have a dynamic, will move as a whole, right? Which makes the dynamics, of course, very, very slow, because if you want to turn such a big region, then you have to turn over the entire thing as a whole. Okay, so now you can ask, what is the contribution of these islands, of these Griffiths regions here, to the thermodynamics in this temperature region here? And it has been shown by Griffiths a long time ago for the classical case that the existence of these regions leads to a singular free energy everywhere in this temperature region here, not just at the critical point. However, it turns out that for the classical case, these Griffiths effects are very, very weak, because essentially you have to combine the exponentially small probability of finding a region like this with an contribution which each island makes, which only goes like some power law. Right? So you play an exponential and a power law together, and this only can only make a finite contribution, and a very small one. So therefore, classical Griffiths singularities are weak, and to the best of my knowledge, there's no experimental confirmation of this classical Griffiths effect so far. Now let's go on and look what happened. Dynamics is a different story. For the dynamics, the Griffiths effects are much stronger even in the classical case. Yes. That may be, But the theory predicts, in contrast to the thermodynamics, very strong effects for the classical dynamics. Okay, now let's look at the quantum case. So what changes is, of course, again, the appearance of this imaginary time direction.
Why are they hard to observe? I mean, aren't the predictions that rather than exponential decay, you have fractional exponential decay of correlation? And why don't you see that? You need a good system. We were trying to get the spin glass system, which were predicted to show Griffiths phases. And the dynamics were so complicated we couldn't sort it out.
Yeah, I mean, of course, but you would want to avoid frustrated systems, right? Because then the physics becomes much more complicated.
Yes, the dynamics is so slow and have vast distributions of time scales. And it's sort out a specific
So you would
understood what time scale you need to go to see the singularity?
Well, if you would have a system without frustration, then it should not be too bad, right? But it may be an experimental problem. I don't know. Okay, so in the quantum case, we again have this extra direction, and the disorder is perfectly correlated in this direction, right? Which now means that our rare regions, right, they are now taking strange shape in this mapped picture, right? They are finite in the space dimensions, right? Because this is produced by the disorder fluctuations. But once I have put my impurities in particular positions, then they will stay the same for all times. So therefore, this rare region now becomes infinitely long in this imaginary time direction, right? So it's clear, intuitively, from what I've told you so far, that this should, again, increase the effects of these rare regions, because in some sense, they just become much bigger, right? They had a finite volume before. Now, in this map picture here, they are infinite, right? So it becomes much harder to turn them over. And indeed, if you again look at this random quantizing model, which I showed you before, and look at the effects of these rare regions in the vicinity but not at the critical point, then you find that now you can get a big contribution. And the difference is that now the contribution a single of these rare regions make increases exponentially with the volume. That's a difference from the case before, where it only grew like a power law, right? And therefore now, if you just add up the contributions from all of these regions, you have to play an exponentially small probability to find one against an exponentially large contribution each of these islands will make. And it's clear that these two exponentials can produce something strong. And indeed, if you work it out, and this has been done by Daniel Fisher and also by Peter Young a couple of years ago, then you find that indeed you find power laws in several observables at low temperatures. I've written down this the susceptibility here, which goes like a power law in the temperature. Also, the specific heat would pick up a power law. And what I should say is that, unfortunately, the exponents here are non-universal. Right? So the value of this exponent changes in the Griffiths region. And therefore, it's very hard to find a specific signature, for, like a specific exponent that one should look for. Right? Of how far you are away from the clean or dirty critical points. For, let's say as a function of disorder, for instance, or as a function of pressure, whatever you use to tune, right? Yeah, I will talk about that in a general picture in detail. But one way to look at it is that, of course, this here looks like a one-dimensional Ising model, right? At least for Ising symmetry. And we know that this is at the exactly at its lower critical dimension. And at the lower critical dimension, we expect exponential volume dependence or length dependence of the susceptibility.
Everything is WKB.
Pardon?
WKB tells you that the barrier is exponential and the volume.
Yeah. It's a different way of looking at it, right? Okay. And similar power laws are also found in specific heat and other observables, right? So now let's go a little further and let's look at itinerant systems. I suppose many of you are interested more in metallic systems than in the insulating systems which I've been talking about so far. So let's look at a metallic magnet. And just for definiteness, I've written down the Gaussian propagator for an anti-ferromagnet, but I could as well have written down the ferromagnet. But what I'm going to say will be valid for both systems. So what is the crucial difference between the damped case, where we have electrons around, and the undamped case? The crucial difference is that in the presence of itinerant electrons, the time dependence here reflects a lambda damping, right? So we get a mod omega damped over damped dynamics instead of an omega squared, which you would get for the random quantum Ising model for undamped dynamics.
You get that analytically by migrating up from. How safe is that?
I don't know, and that's a different question, right? So yeah, that's. But of course, it's clear as long as you get something which is different from omega squared here, you will get stronger effects. So if it's not mod omega, but something more complicated, then the overall picture still applies, even though the specific results would have to be adjusted. But, let's for the moment just assume that the Hertz picture is valid. For the systems we are looking at, and let's continue what the consequences of disorder are in this picture, right?
So you can also say that you don't have to be at a critical point, right? In the map, that's okay. And you have the same argument with Peter Powell.
Well, you are still close to the critical point, and then maybe a crossover problem, or
I'm
yeah.
Concerned about the influence of the critical point on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I understand what you're saying.
Yeah. Okay. So. Okay, that's probably okay. Yeah. So now, if you look at what that corresponds in if you do the Fourier transform back to the imaginary time, then you see, of course, this is a long range interaction in time, and actually it's 1/Tau², right? So then if you go, we go back and look at our region, this one here, right, which still has the same shape, but now we have a long ridge interaction along this direction, right, 1 over tau squared. Okay, so now there comes a crucial step. Step is that much is known about Ising models with the 1 over r squared interaction. And what we need is that it's known that a 1 over r squared Ising model has an ordered phase. It has a true phase transition in contrast to a short-range one-dimensional Ising model. So what that means is that an isolated rare region, which corresponds to a one-dimensional Ising rod with a 1 over r squared interaction, can undergo the phase transition completely independent from the rest of the system, right? So therefore, it can develop a static magnetization, which of course is just another word for saying that large islands do not tunnel anymore, right? Because developing a static magnetization means they don't turn over, right? So large enough islands will not tunnel, and therefore we won't get conventional Griffiths effects, because if the islands become static, there will be no contribution to the coming from the turning over of islands, which is the conventional Griffiths picture. Instead, the magnetization develops gradually and essentially independent on several regions in space. And this is what constitutes a smeared transition, right? Yeah, the islands do become classical, yes, yeah. But, sure.
No critical point at all, or?
Yes, there's no critical point.
Did they worry about interacting between variables? It's only anchoring out the electrons when they're
yes. Yeah, sure. So what happens if you come from the disordered phase and move into the ordered phase, right, is that first you will start developing these classical or static magnetization on islands very far apart, right? Those which happen to be the biggest or the most strongly coupled. And then if you move further into the ordered phase, of course, at some point the interaction between them becomes important, and then maybe percolation effects start to play a role. This is not really clear. But in the beginning, if you start to move into the towards the ordered phase, they are clearly very, very far apart, right? And so therefore, at that point, interactions should have a small effect, right? Okay. So here's a cartoon of what to expect in terms of a phase diagram in such a situation, right? So you have your control parameter versus temperature, and this could be disorder. And you come down here, and then you develop an exponential tail. And I have to say, of course, that in a realistic system, what's happening in the tail may be much more complicated than just ferromagnetism or antiferromagnetism, because in a metallic system, there will be RKKY interactions, and there may be maybe spin class order down in the tail, so that's not really clear, right? But clearly, there will not be a sharp phase transition between a non-magnet and a magnet, because these islands develop static order independently, right? And one possible realization well, if you have a finite density of islands, right, then of course they make a small but non-zero contribution to the order parameter.
They're farther because they're only dragged.
Right.
Yeah,
you said they independent, so
there, of course, there will be a small residual interaction which will align them in some way or the other. And if you forget about
that's the hard problem, you can't avoid that problem. You know, because the rest interaction.
I'm not entirely sure whether that's true, right? Because if the islands are actually classical, then you only need an infinitesimally small interaction to align them, right? You don't need a finite interaction. An infinitesimally small interaction or field will align them. And either ferromagnetically or in spin glass fashion if RKKY becomes important, right? We have, for instance, right? Yes, a small field would also do it. And again, in theory at least, an infinitesimally small field would do it because the islands are classical. Okay, now just today that indeed in nickel palladium, which has been long been seen as one of the examples of a ferromagnetic quantum phase transition, if you go to low enough temperatures, indeed there is a tail where people have observed spin glass type of effects, right? Which could point to something like I'm talking about. Give me a minute, and we'll come to that. It's different. So since I'm kind of running out of time, I will. Okay, let me make one remark about.
Technically, you have.
Yeah. Well, there was a few questions which I take off from the 10 minutes. Let me make one remark about the universality of this scenario. So from what I said, it should be clear that the condition which you need to get this type of smearing is that an isolated region can develop a static order parameter, right? And then it's clear that this is not restricted to this particular system, which I talked about so far. It can also happen in classical magnets if you make your defects two-dimensional, which is somewhat artificial, admittedly, but nonetheless, for a classical magnet, with planar defects, it will happen. And we have computer simulations which show it. Or you can look at non-equilibrium phase transitions, where you only need linear defects. This, again, the same happens. So that's a very universal scenario which can happen if your rare regions are above the lower critical dimension of the problem, because then they can develop static order. And let me jump the simulation results, and let me attempt the classification, and which will also at least partially answer your question. So we can try to classify these quantum phase transitions with weak disorder according to the effective dimensionality of the rare regions. And there are three cases. The rare regions can have a smaller dimensionality than the lower critical dimension of the problem, which of course is a generic case in classical systems, because there the rare regions are just zero-dimensional, right? And in this case, the Griffiths effects will be weakly exponential because you play the exponential rarity of the occurrence of an island against some power law, right? So you have classical magnets with point defects, and there's also quantum systems which fall into this class. Then you can have the case where the islands happen to be exactly at the lower critical dimension of the problem. This is a case where you play one exponential against the other, and you, as a result, you get power law Griffiths effects. And this seems to be connected always with an infinite randomness fixed point, also I've not been able so far to actually prove that one follows from the other here. And examples are the random quantizing model, which I mentioned, a classical Ising model with linear defects, which is essentially the same, and also the itinerant Heisenberg quantum magnet should fall into this class. Also, there is a question mark here which has to do with the island-island interaction. And then the last case is what I was talking about. If the regions are above the lower critical dimension, then they become static. We get a smear transition, and this can be observed in the itinerant Ising magnet or in the classical Ising model with planar defects. And with this attempted classification, I guess I should stop.
Question. Yes. What would happen in an itinerant electron system? You can sometimes imagine the disorder helps ferromagnetism
rather
than punitive.
Yeah.
Would your scenario still hold?
I think maybe with slight modifications, but all you need is that you have local variations of the tendency towards magnetism, whether that's where many impurities are, or whether this enhanced regions correspond to regions with less impurities, it's not important for the picture. So yes, it could something very similar could happen in this case too.
Your message here
but
is
I,
that
yeah.
There is no quantum critical point.
In the idealized picture, there would be no quantum critical point, and this tail would stretch all the way to 0% nickel. Of course, as I said, in a realistic system, there may be more complicated stuff going on in the very tail, with RKKY becoming important and spin class order. But if you forget about this complication for a second, then all the way to zero nickel, there would be some possibility of having an island with enough nickel, which makes them a piece of the ordered phase.
Yeah. In this system, and there's a whole host of other systems, palladium, manganese, cobalt, iron, etc., which are usually considered to be percolator systems, your phase diagram comes down very sharply with a ferromagnetic PC, and then the tail resembles a spin glass freezing
temperature.
The great advantage of these systems are, the advantage is, there's no Kondo effect here, because everything is going ferromagnetic. Now, suppose you had a system where there was a finite Kondo temperature, or even due to the disorder, a Kondo disorder model was applicable. How would this change the situation? I thought one of the first realizations of the Griffith phase was in the Kondo disorder model.
That's a different picture, right? And here I'm talking about Griffith effects which come from islands which are close or add magnetic ordering, right? The Griffith disorder is Kondo disorder is a very different picture. Yeah. Yeah.
So you got half the spins
Now, if you do that experimentally, are you actually just diluting or is it introducing frustration? Because the interaction is long range, right? If I remember correctly, in space.
Right. So
yeah.
The system does have some frustration in that it's by
holes. Yeah. So. So again, I don't know. It's clear that if frustration does plays a role, which I don't know in this case, then the picture would be much more complicated than the simple picture which I tried to develop here. Okay, this is something which I'm not entirely sure of, because clearly what's happening here out in the tail is essentially independent of very weakly coupled islands.
But this is
an exponential tail, right? The temperature here is exponentially small, right? But what happens here, I admittedly do not fully understand. Whether it's just simple percolation or something more complicated, this upturn here, right, which is seen in simulations too, this is not entirely clear what's happening there. Therefore, I'm not really in the position to answer the question.
In these simulations that you skipped, does it happen at a realistic temperature?
It's hard to say, because it's really toy models which we simulated. So I don't know what realistic would mean in that context.
Five seconds. I just wanted to warn everyone, when John's talking about what a wonderful system he's on, there are very well known to John better than I, materials problem, so that the experimentalists should be cautious when they look at data, because there's some extreme sample dependence on how homogeneous you've made your sample.
But that's consistent with this picture, right? I mean,
there's no short range order causing cluster in these systems. And these, particularly palladium iron, has been followed down to parts per million and microkelvin. This is done for well by Warren, and he keeps getting the spin glass. And spin glasses always go to freezing temperatures and power loss, so they're not exponentially cutting off. And as far before he runs out of his microkelvin and his parts per million, he's still getting a spin glass phase. And I don't think they're heavily influenced by the power that you make a loop plane and yourself. There are other ones, I think the cobalt gets you into a little bit of trouble and you begin to get clustering.
Just pointing out there was a diff in the center.
If you make loop plane samples.
We were behind the bar before we got the
I find it uncomfortable except you expect quantum fluctuations anyway. So, financial inference.
And there's if you look what's happening here, there's two scales involved, right? One is the scale where effectively the big islands become classical, right? And then there is another scale where actually the residual island-island interaction or small field would actually align them, right? And only the second scale is the one which is shown here, whereas the first scale would be responsible for whether or not Griffith effects play a role for transport or something like this, because below the first scale, which is much further up, because it only corresponds to a single island becoming static, has nothing to do with the density of islands. Below that, again, the islands are static and then don't follow the Griffith physics anymore.
Thanks very much.